Welcome to the primary edition of your local talking newspaper covering St Albans, Harpenden and all the villages within the district. You've just heard a piece of music called Striding Out. We hope you enjoyed listening to it. We'll be playing more of it a little later on. Our thanks go to Goffby for allowing us to use his music. Today's edition of Primary is for week ending the 8th of February 2020. The news items come from the Hearts Advertiser and the Review. Now, here's my first news item. And the headline is, "We must unite to tackle crime." "We have no need to fear crime," is the message of the heart of a fortnight interview with St Albans' leading police officer in this week's Hearts Advertiser. Chief Inspector Linda Coates was asked to directly address a spate of gang-related incidents which have shocked the public in recent weeks. These include several violent assaults in the vicinity of Clarence Park. She stressed that those responsible were a small group of individuals and they were largely committing acts of violence against each other. "They're known to us. It's really, really small minority of people who are committing violent acts." But Chief Inspector Coates emphasised how the public can play a crucial role in helping to reduce incidents of crime in the community by acting in partnership with the police. "The public are the police and the police are the public," she told the Hearts Advertiser. Now, have your say on crime prevention within the district. St Albans businesses, community groups and residents are invited to have their say on how crime prevention can be improved in the district. A public consultation has started to shape a plan for making St Albans a safer place to live and work, covering topics such as antisocial behaviour, drug dealing, burglary, knife crime and street drinking. The consultation is running until Sunday, February the 29th, and is intended to help the St Albans Community Safety Partnership, CSP, complete its strategy for the following year. The CSP is a group of agencies which work together to reduce crime in the district. Members include St Albans District Council, Hearts Police, the Police and Crime Commissioner, Hertfordshire Fire and Rescue Service, and various voluntary organisations. They consult annually with residents and local groups to identify strategic aims and priorities. Priorities for 2020 to 2021 are to establish an effective response to violent crime, focus on possession crime, such as burglary and vehicle theft, assist landowners, businesses and the community by tackling rural crimes such as fly tipping, antisocial behaviour and violent crime, and to support victims of domestic abuse by tackling perpetrators and educating people about healthy relationships and personal safety. They also aim to promote physical and mental well-being by tackling hate crime, alcohol and drug misuse, homelessness and street drinking, as well as assisting vulnerable people at home and in the community. Councillor Jackie Taylor, portfolio holder for Housing, Inclusion and Protection, said St Albans District is fortunate to have relatively low crime levels, but we cannot take this for granted. Community Safety Partnership wants to win the battle against crime and respond effectively to the needs of the people who live and work here. To do so, we need to hear their views on how we can improve and where our priorities should lie.
Hello, I'm Sally and this is my first news item. It's about a volunteer who's received a Stronger Together award from a charity. A St Albans woman has won an award for her work volunteering for Crohn's and Colitis UK, including posing for photos in the charity's leaflets. Lorraine Hammond was presented with the Stronger Together award at the charity's headquarters in Hatfield on Thursday, January the 30th, as part of a ceremony highlighting the essential work that volunteers provide. Lorraine said, "Shortly after retiring, I decided I wanted to volunteer to do something worthwhile in the local community. I attended a volunteer event and I met a representative from Crohn's and Colitis UK. He talked about Crohn's and Colitis and inspired me to try and help in some way as a volunteer. I volunteered for what I thought was just a couple of photos to be taken by the marketing team, but to my surprise, when I arrived, it was a photo shoot with role-play scenarios. I enjoyed the session, which gave them a bank of photos to use, and it's still a surprise to see myself in their leaflets." More than 300,000 people in the UK are living with Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, which are both lifelong conditions. All the volunteers who were nominated for awards were chosen for embodying the charity's values of being compassionate, ambitious, and stronger together, breaking ground with new practices or supporting the cause across the board. Lorraine said, "I have learnt so much about the disease, which I knew nothing about before volunteering. In my daily life, I have come across so many people with Crohn's and colitis and can now understand their issues more clearly and point them in the right direction to get the support that they need." The charity's volunteer development manager, April Tawaki, said, "We are thrilled to recognise the massive achievements for our incredible volunteers with our awards. Our volunteers constantly inspire and amaze me at the dedicated time and effort they put in towards supporting the cause and the charity. We have hundreds of incredible volunteers, but it was fantastic to give this Stronger Together award to Lorraine today and recognise all her achievements, so a big well done to her." And the article is accompanied by a picture of Lorraine receiving her award from Sue Cherry, the head of the Board of Trustees at Crohn's and Colitis UK.
Hello, this is Bill Whittock. My first piece is concerning the Agricultural and Food Tech Hub planned for Rothamsted. Rothamsted Research Centre in Harpenden is to undergo renovations to become a hub for the agriculture and food technology businesses. Thanks to a £1.7 million joint local growth fund investment from Hertfordshire Local Enterprise Partnership, LEP, and Hertfordshire Innovation Quarter, Hearts IQ, the centre's Russell Building will be renovated to provide office space. The building, which has lain empty since 2014, is of historic importance as a home for agricultural science. Pioneering statistician Ronald Aylmer Fisher worked in the Russell, and scientists who created the first pyrethroid insecticides based there. Once renovated, the building will house 22 offices and will accommodate up to 118 people in spaces ranging from 200 square feet to 1,200 square feet. These will include an open plan innovation space where entrepreneurs could work together before testing their ideas on site, as well as spaces and offices for startups and businesses. Rothamsted Research Interim Institute Director and Chief Executive Angela Karp said, "We are delighted by this development. Bringing together entrepreneurs on campus with our world-class scientists, I'm confident that we look forward to a new era of groundbreaking innovation in agricultural science and technology at Rothamsted." As a founding partner of Hearts IQ, Rothamsted Research is helping to build a cluster of green businesses in the Hertfordshire Enterprise Zone. Demand for more open space has also been boosted by the launch of the Shake Climate Change programme, and Rothamsted Research's AgriTech Research Innovation Accelerator, AGRIA, which encourages cross-working across various sciences. Paul Whitcomb, Head of Enterprise and Innovation at Hearts LEP, said, "This will provide much-needed growth on space for high-tech, high-growth gazelle companies within this burgeoning sector. By bringing this prominent building back into use, it sends a very clear message that Hertfordshire is the home of innovation and enable Rothamsted to continue to foster open collaboration between business and science."
Hello, I'm Bill Lawley-York, and my first article is regarding hospital plans to tackle long A&E waiting times. Emergency doctors in Watford General treated up to 366 patients in a single day over the festive period, St Albans councillor have been told. During a 12-month period, the hospital's emergency department, which is run by the West Hearts Hospital Trust, now sees more than 100,000 patients, an average of around 290 a day, with 366 on the busiest day. The figures were revealed to a meeting of the St Albans Health and Wellbeing Partnership on Tuesday, January the 26th. The Trust's Divisional General Manager, Stephanie Johnson, said, "The number of patients turning up at A&E was increasing by around 7.5%. but that the hospital was still bucking the national trend and decreasing waiting times. Data from March last year shows that just 77% of patients at A&E were seen within 4 hours, compared to a national median of 84. However, more recent data from December shows that 82% of patients are seen within 4 hours, compared to a national median of 79. Stephanie said, although not meeting the national standard, we are bucking the trend in improving performance. We have had a very strong improvement plan in place that has contributed to this improving performance. She added that the hospital had implemented a number of measures designed to improve the flow of patients and treat them as quickly as possible. These include an ambulance liaison officer to help with patients brought in by ambulance. An ambulatory care unit runs alongside for patients who can be treated within a day rather than having to be admitted. Senior consultants in fields such as general medicine, cardiology, respiratory conditions also spend time in the department to cut down delays. Further measures planned include a CT scanner at A&E, the opening of an urgent treatment centre and expansion of the medical assessment unit. Harts Valley's clinical commissioning group are also trying to increase accessibility to GP appointments. Councillor Josie Medock, who had to wait 10 hours for her father to be admitted at Watford General in December, praised the care he received at the hospital. She said the care he received during that time was outstanding. He was treated extremely well.
Amazing community response after equipment stolen from Forest School. A Forest School for children with disabilities in St Albans raised more than £700 to replace equipment which was stolen and vandalised. Watling View School, which caters for children aged 2 to 19 with learning difficulties, has a separate woodland forest school site where pupils go to spend time outdoors. The forest school was broken into on Monday, January the 13th, by vandals who stole tools and equipment, including a garden trolley, hammocks, gardening tools, gardening gloves, toys, and a rucksack containing a first aid kit and waterproof clothes. A Just Giving campaign was set up to raise £500 to replace the stolen items, but has already raised £767. Margaret Stone, whose daughter Flo works at the Forest School, said many of the items taken were old and of little value to anyone other than the children and dedicated staff, who were upset by what has happened. A place where they enjoyed a secure space to explore and play is now going to need considerable work and time to restore. But getting the children to feel happy and at home without the familiar equipment will be much harder. Among the missing items was a collection of tools Flo gathered herself, including a small axe belonging to her uncle, who died 2 years ago. Flo said, "Over the last few years, we've built up a stock of tools, equipment and resources which are familiar to the students and facilitate their learning and their ability to help with jobs which maintain the woodland. Losing some of these completely and finding others broken or damaged has been upsetting for the students, some of whom find it difficult to understand why familiar resources are missing. However, we're so inspired and delighted by the response of the local community. An initial request on Facebook's St Albans Reuse project has had an amazing community response, and we've received donations of tools, hammocks and equipment. The Forest School aims to provide hands-on learning about the wood and the plants and animals which live there. Any money left over will go towards the school's project to convert an internal courtyard into a sensory garden and play area for the pupils."
My next article reports that the Save Simonshide campaign is rejoicing after the latest proposed amendments to the Welwyn Hatfield local plan includes removing the Simonshide development. This group has been campaigning for years to prevent any new houses and roads being built in the area, which is situated between Hatfield and St Albans, to protect the outstanding area of Greenbelt. In an email, John Gardner, chair of the Save Simonshide campaign, said, After almost 4 years of campaigning and following a remarkable turn of events last week, we can announce that Welwyn Hatfield Borough Council have agreed to remove the Simonside development proposals from the draft local plan. We are all delighted with the news, and we know that you will be too. Together with higher annual windfall assumptions, the total number of new homes proposed for the local plan will be just over 14,000 over 16 years, significantly lower than the 16,000 homes original target. The new lower figure allowed for all proposed development in Simonside to be removed from the plan, preventing great harm to the Greenbelt was also a deciding factor. The planning inspector had already scheduled a site-specific hearing to discuss all issues relating to the proposed development of Simonside on March the 11th, but campaigners are now waiting to find out whether the inspector would agree to cancel the hearing. It is possible that the inspector will hold the hearing in order to give all parties, including the landowner or developer, a chance to present their evidence. Mr. Gardner added, "We do need more housing, but we believe that Simonside was and remains an entirely unsuitable option, that it should be permanently removed from consideration. We are not resting on our laurels, but we do need to give thanks to everyone who's fought to achieve this outcome. Local councillors committed to good decision-making and democratic process have helped and supported us throughout. With your support, we will continue to fight to keep Simonside open and keep it the open, beautiful, windswept and wild place that we all love, available for all local people. A 6-week consultation on all sites in the plan will open later this month." The article is accompanied by a picture of campaigners Chris Oxley and John Gardner standing in the middle of Simonside.
Smart motorway plans for the A1M put on hold, though start date for work looms. Construction work to convert parts of the A1M into a smart motorway in Hertfordshire have been put on hold until the government review is complete. After smart motorways were linked with an increase in road deaths, Transport Secretary Grant Shapps said all plans should be put on hold. Highways England has confirmed this is the case for the A1M, despite work being due to start in March. The results of the review are expected to be released soon, although no date has been given. Highways England's current plan is to turn the A1M between Junction 6 for Welwyn and Junction 8 for Stevenage into a smart motorway northbound and southbound. There have been calls to scrap all smart motorways, citing that they are too dangerous, with one concern that emergency refuge areas are not frequent enough. Welwyn Garden MP Grant Shapps spoke to BBC Panorama on the topic. "I think the emergency refuge areas are almost certainly in some cases too far apart. I think 2.5 miles is much too much. People need to be passing these every 60 seconds at a normal speed. The death toll on stretches of the smart motorways has reached 38 in the last 5 years. He added, "I'm very unhappy about there being so many different types of motorway. I don't think that we should continue with dynamic motorways and all-lane running and smart motorways. It's just too confusing. We absolutely have to have these as safe or safer than regular motorways. We shouldn't be having them at all." The Welwyn Hatfield Liberal Democrats had written to Mr. Shapps, asking him to put the plans on hold until safety issues have been thoroughly reviewed. Hearts County Councillor Nigel Quinton said, "Of course we want to see an end to the daily snarl-ups on the A1M, but this cannot be at the expense of safety. If we are all to have all lanes running, then it is vital there are frequent emergency refuges. These are dangerously far apart on the M25, as BBC reports highlight."
Marathon Man to launch regional mental health hub. A man who ran 401 marathons in 401 days is launching a sports hub in Hertfordshire for the mental health charity Mind. Marathon runner Ben Smith will launch the Mind East Regional Hub for sport and physical activity at the University of Hertfordshire on Wednesday, February the 12th. Ben used running as a means of countering mental health issues throughout his life. including low self-esteem and issues surrounding bullying, sexuality, and suicide. The initiative is being delivered by MIND alongside the Heart Sports and Physical Activity Partnership, abbreviated to HSP. HSP Director John O'Callaghan said, "There is empirical evidence showing how involvement in sport and physical activity can be a significant contributor to positive mental health. Involvement in sport and physical activity can help individuals develop friendships, improve confidence and self-esteem, and build essential resilience needed to meet the challenges of daily life. We are delighted to have been chosen by MIND to lead the regional hub for mental health, sport and physical activity for the East of England, and we look forward to working with our sister organisations in Norfolk, Suffolk, Bedfordshire, Essex and Cambridgeshire in heightening awareness of mental health issues and the benefits from involvement in positive sport and physical activity programmes. We are also delighted that Ben Smith has agreed to join us for the launch and look forward to him sharing his remarkable feats. Ben is a glowing example of how physical activity can be used to enhance mental health, and we are looking forward to him sharing his remarkable journey with us. Ben plans to travel to the USA and complete a further 50 marathons in each of the states, cycling between marathon routes. A webinar and question and answer session with Ben will also be held at the launch at 12:30 p.m. and is open to anyone with an interest in mental health and sports. The launch webinar will also be used to outline HSP's proposal to heighten awareness of mental health issues and to take a lead in ensuring they are considered as part of the delivery of sports and physical activity programmes.
St Albans MP Daisy Cooper has called on the government to reduce the time it takes for children to receive special needs assessments. Families currently have to wait for 20 weeks for their child to receive a special educational needs and disability assessment, which Daisy said was far too long. In a parliamentary debate, Daisy highlighted the plight of children in Hearts County Council-run schools, where as many as 1 in 7 pupils are kept waiting for longer than the statutory time limit. "I can see the enormous strain that families face when a school is unable to cater for their child's needs, or when they have to wait weeks for an assessment. If all our children to receive the life chances they deserve, we need the government to invest properly to ensure they get adequate support and intervention at the right time."
The St Albans branch of Greenpeace hosted a photo exhibition to highlight the threat of climate change on the world's oceans. The Protect the Oceans exhibition was held on Monday, January the 27th at the Odyssey Cinema and featured photos of wildlife such as walruses, whales, giant jellyfish and penguins. All the photos were taken on board the Greenpeace ship, the Esperanza, which is travelling from pole to pole and is currently in the Antarctic. St Albans volunteer Juliet Voisey said, "We've put on this exhibition ahead of the final UN negotiations in March on a global ocean treaty to show the risks that wildlife face from overfishing, melting ice and plastic pollution. It is vital that we protect at least 30% of our oceans by 2030. St Albans MP Daisy Cooper is pictured attending the event, and she also signed a letter to Boris Johnson asking for a senior minister to attend the Global Ocean Treaty negotiations.
Primary school knife panic after pupil brings in a toy. Parents were in a panic after hearing reports about a boy taking a knife into a primary school. A Year 4 student at Park Street Church of England School took a suspected knife into class on Tuesday, January the 28th. The boy allegedly took it out and showed it to 4 class friends in the school shed during break time. Year 4 parents were sent a letter which explained students were safe but did not elaborate on the details. Head teacher Wendy May Foster said, "The safety and security of the children and staff that attend my school is of the utmost importance to me. I can confirm that a pupil brought into school what has been confirmed as a toy knife. As soon as I was made aware of this, I ensured the safeguarding team, governors and the police were informed and that all county council procedures and guidelines were adhered to throughout this investigation. I have ensured parents have been kept up to date throughout this process. My team have offered support to anyone who might have been affected, she added. Police have confirmed that there was no intent to harm. According to police, the pupil was showing the knife to their peers and at no point was any threat made. Officers from the safety neighbourhood team attended the school to speak with staff, but they did not seize the knife, which they described as rounded with no sharp edges, as it did not pose a threat and no crime had been committed. The team also met with the child and the parents to give words of advice on the incident. As a result of the incident, officers will be attending the school this week to talk to children about the dangers of carrying knives.
Mother of newborn baby in council row over planning permission. A St Albans mother with a two-week-old baby had to digest the news that planning permission, which had already been verbally granted, was done so in error. Hilary Child's dream house conversion has turned into a nightmare due to apparent council malpractice. The 43-year-old wanted to transform her terraced property in Cavendish Road by demolishing an old extension to the rear of the property, replacing it with a bright and airy orangery-style kitchen and upstairs extension for a new bathroom. But things went drastically wrong just before the birth of her second child, after a visit from a planning officer from the District Council's planning department. The officer carried out a full inspection of the property before telling Hilary he was going to recommend approval for her plans, and she could expect to receive written confirmation in a matter of weeks. Overjoyed with the news, she instructed her builders to begin internal work, including relocating a staircase and bedroom and ordering panes of glass for the orangery. Hilary said the officer said, after meeting us, that he was completely happy with the plans and agreed that the extension was totally fine and we were good to go. I spoke to my builder and we decided to put the staircase in as this would mean that we were ready to start when we got written approval. When the deadline had passed for the written confirmation, and after chasing for a response, she received an unexpected phone call from the planning department. They informed her that the officer had been pulled off her case and the application would have to be considered from scratch. Unfortunately, the second inspection yielded a completely different result, with officers deciding to reject the plans because of concerns about the light being cut off for a neighbouring property, leaving Hilary thousands of pounds out of pocket because of the work already carried out. She said, "Now this has been rejected. They have suggested I flip the whole layout of the original house around or go into the loft, losing one bedroom of a two-bed house. The council actually agreed neither of these options were fair to me, but when I asked for further input, this was all they could suggest. Now Hilary wants compensation from the district council because of the perceived professional negligence of their employee and an apology for the distress it has caused immediately following the birth of her new daughter. I'm furious that I was misinformed from the outset and now left with a house with nowhere to put a bathroom," she said. "I cannot understand how this can happen, and I'm sure I'm not the only one affected. The correct process is that after a site visit and full assessment of the proposal, including consideration of neighbour comments and consultee responses, all case officers write a report making a recommendation. This recommendation is then considered by a senior officer or a planning committee who makes the decision. In a letter clarifying the situation, the planning department's development manager said, "When giving any advice, an officer should make this clear, and I apologise that this has not happened in this case." Head of Planning for St Albans Council, Tracy Harvey, said, "I can confirm that we've recently received a complaint about how a particular planning application was handled. We are carrying out an investigation before responding formally." The application was for a two-storey extension in place of an existing one-storey one. It was refused late last month, January, after an objection was received on the grounds of the adverse impact it would have on an adjoining house. There is little else I can say while the inquiry is underway, except that anyone who starts building work before an application is granted does so at their own risk.
Council exec's salary 4 times higher than average. The lowest paid council employee earned £19,404. The chief executive of St Albans District Council was paid £104,060 last year, more than 5 times the salary of the council's lowest paid member of staff. The figures were presented to the Council's Planning Resources, Housing and Commercial Scrutiny Committee as part of the annual review of the Council's pay policy last Tuesday, January the 21st. They showed that the lowest paid employee in the Council, excluding apprenticeships, earned £19,404 last year, including a £609 Outer London Fringe payment. And that means for every pound paid to the lowest paid employee, the chief executive was paid £5.36. The report also compares the salary of the chief executive's pay to the average salary across the entire council workforce, where the median pay figure is taken into account. And according to this measure, the top salary was 4 times higher than the average. According to the report to the committee, guidelines from the Hutton Review suggest the pay of a chief executive should not be more than 20 times that of the lowest paid employees. At the meeting of the committee, councillors also backed a number of changes to the council's pay policy that will be determined by a meeting of the full council next month. They backed plans to formalise the deputy head of service role within the pay grade structure and to adjust pay grade boundaries to those staff at grade 6 or above to bring pay in line with neighbouring authorities. Grade 6 is typically middle-ranking council officers, including many of the technical and professional staff, such as surveyors and planners, where salaries currently range between £27,905 and £30,507. They agreed to increase holiday entitlement for staff by 1.5 days in recognition that civic officers would no longer close over the Christmas break, aside from bank holidays. In the past, the civic offices would close, giving staff the additional time off. Now, the offices are used by other public sector partners and the offices will only close on bank holidays. The change means staff will not lose out on the leave they've become used to, but they will be able to take it when they please. Pay policy document will be considered by a meeting of the full council on February 26th.
A strategy for improving the health and well-being of people living in St Albans District has been updated to take account of new projects and initiatives. The strategy launched 2 years ago, and the St Albans Healthy Hub, which is funded by Herts County Council and located within the District Council offices, opened last year. Groups based there include Mind in Mid Herts, Age UK, The Living Room and more, offer residents advice on how to boost their physical and mental health. This month, the Hub also launched free mini-health MOTs provided by leisure contractor One Life. The strategy is the first of its kind and was launched 2 years ago by the St Albans District Health and Wellbeing Partnership. The partnership is made up of the Council and other organisations, including Herts Valley's Clinical Commissioning Group, West Hertfordshire Hospital's NHS Trust, and St Albans and Harpenden Patient Group. Its aims are to encourage healthy lifestyles and reduce health inequalities, with equal weight being given to physical and mental health. Council officers and volunteers representing the Public Health Working Group worked on the revised strategy and formalised it in a meeting on Wednesday, January the 28th. A 20-page document is available to view on the Council's website, containing the latest data about health in the district. for example, showing that 48.9% of the district's residents are overweight. The strategy also details the partnership's long-term goals, which include making the district more dementia-friendly and reducing social isolation and loneliness. Councillor Robert Donald, chair of the partnership and the Public Health Working Group, said, "While we live in a relatively healthy district, with activity levels and rates of early death from cancer and heart disease better than national averages, we are not complacent and we know that improvements can be made. For example, the number of adults overweight and obese has only fallen by less than 1% year on year, and in year 6 children at school it has actually increased by 0.2%. Mental health and reversing the current rise in suicides locally are also both areas of concern addressed in the new strategy."
I have a lovely picture here of a young hedgehog which has been rescued. St Albans schoolboys have been praised after rescuing an abandoned hedgehog. The Year 7 Verum School students found the creature outside of the business teaching block and fetched a box to keep it safe. Head of Year 7, Letitia McAnally, said that they were very concerned about its well-being. "It was lucky that our finance officer looks after hedgehogs and hands them over to a lady called Esther, who runs a London Coney hedgehog rescue. If these lovely boys hadn't intervened, little Holly would have died within 48 hours. They saved its life by caring. To help the London Coney hedgehog rescue further, the boys are going to hold a cake sale on February the 10th in order to raise money for the charity. Some are also going to get involved in releasing the hedgehogs back into the wild."
The electoral map. People across St Albans are invited to take part in a consultation on new council ward boundaries in the district. The Local Government Boundary Commission is holding a 10-week consultation on the draft recommendations, which will end on April the 13th, 2020. Under the recommendations, St Albans District Council would have 56 councillors in future, two fewer than now. Those councillors would represent 16 three-councillor wards and 4 two-councillor wards across the district. The full recommendations and detailed interactive maps will be available to view at consultation.
Police warning over Amazon Prime scam. More and more people have been targeted by an Amazon Prime scam. Hertfordshire Constabulary says it has seen an increase in reports of people receiving the fraudulent phone messages. The force says victims are receiving voicemail messages saying that they are going to be billed for an Amazon Prime subscription. The message directs the victims to press 1 on their keypad to speak to an account manager, after which they are connected to a fraudster who then demands the victim's bank details to cancel the subscription. The scammers have also been asking the victims to download an app called TeamViewer. Once this has been installed on a device, the scammers gain remote access to the device and all the personal data that is stored on it. The council's police force is urging people to stay vigilant. Action Fraud case manager Elaine Crate from Hertfordshire Constabulary's Victim Fraud Hub said, "Amazon will never contact its customers via a phone message and ask you to divulge personal and bank details in this way. We advise never to click on any links or download apps under these circumstances. If you do think you may have given bank details to a fraudster, then please contact your bank immediately. You can report the incident to Action Fraud by telephone on 0300 123 2040. Action Fraud is the UK's national reporting centre for fraud. Alternatively, if you consider yourself vulnerable, please dial 101 to be connected to Hertfordshire Constabulary.
Hertfordshire County Council could increase its share of the council tax bill by 3.99%. The council revealed its plans for the 12 months from April in a draft budget that has been backed by its cabinet and will be scrutinised in coming weeks. The proposal includes plans to increase the County Council's share of the tax by 1.99%, as well as an additional 2% for adult social care. According to the report to the Cabinet, for a typical Band D property, that would increase their council tax from £1,359.94 to £1,414.20. That's an increase of £4.52 a month. It highlights £17 million of cost efficiencies. But the council also promises significant investment, more than £38 million, in the adult social care workforce, children in care, roads and public transport. At a meeting of the Cabinet on Monday, January the 20th, Executive Member for Resources and Performance, Councillor Ralph Sangster, outlined the proposals. He acknowledged that the Council had been through a significant period of financial consolidation over the past decade, during which the Council had saved almost £2 billion. But he said the latest budget proposals would see the first real expansion of service delivery for some time. He highlighted £10 million earmarked to support public transport, £8 million to invest in the road network and £8 million to support children in care. He also pointed to £12 million that would be invested in the county's home care workforce.
The Harpenden Society has opened its annual awards to all residents in Harpenden rather than just society members. For more than 40 years, the Society has given awards for buildings and site developments in the town, with only members eligible for nominations. This year, any resident can make a nomination as part of the Society's efforts to attract a younger demographic. The awards will be announced at the annual general meeting in April, followed by official presentations to the winners. Any building or development can be nominated, providing it was completed in 2019, has agricultural merit and benefits the town's residents. The Society is also holding its first public meeting of the year on Thursday, February 27th, with MP Bim Afolame as guest speaker.
Now here are the radio listings, and we'll kick off this week with those programmes repeated from Monday to Friday. The Book of the Week at 9:45 a.m., and repeated at 12:30 a.m. on Radio 4, is How to Argue with a Racist by Adam Rutherford. The book tables spurious race science and questions its historic role in racist ideology. The 15-minute drama at 10:45 a.m., repeated at 7:45 p.m. on Radio 4, is the continuation of Katie Hymm's 24 Kildare Road. The Composer of the Week on Radio 3 at noon is Beethoven. The 12:04 p.m. novel, starting this week and repeated at 10:45 p.m., is Benjamin Black's mystery, The Secret Guests. Set in 1940 at the height of the Blitz, Princesses Elizabeth and Margaret are secretly evacuated to a rural estate in neutral Ireland. The author was told the tale by a friend whose father was in charge of the princess's security. Equal as we are, 1,000 years of not listening is at 1:45 p.m. on Radio 4. It examines literary encounters between men and women. Starting with Lancelot and Lady Philo from Maud d'Arthur, we will also hear from Adam and Eve and the proposal scene from Pride and Prejudice. The afternoon drama on Radio 4 unusually starts on Saturday at 2:45 p.m. and continues from Monday at 2:15 p.m. It is an adaptation of Emile Zola's novel cycle, chronicling three branches of a family living during the Second French Empire. This, the first season, is entitled Blood, Glenda Jackson, Robert Lindsay and Fenella Woolgar. The great classic The Count of Monte Cristo can be heard at 3 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra from Monday to Thursday. It stars Ian Glen, Jane Lapater and Toby Jones. At 8 p.m. on Classic FM, the Full Works Concert offers 2 hours of well-known classical music.
We now come to the choice of programmes for the week, beginning on Saturday the 8th of February with The Inn, a dramatisation of the story by Guy de Maupassant, Quite a French flavour to the week so far. This is at 6 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra. There is Opera on 3, Radio 3 at 6:30 p.m. and it is Berlioz's The Damnation of Faust. 3 hours of crime can be heard on Radio 4 Extra from 7 p.m. when Mark Billingham scours the radio archives for the best examples of crime fiction. There is a musical choice at 9 p.m. between, on Radio 2, Seth Wakeman's Folk Map of the British Isles and on Classic FM, Beethoven, The Man Revealed, introduced by John Suchet. On Sunday, 9th of February, the selection begins at 3 p.m. on Radio 4 with Part 2 of the drama Black Water, An American Story by Joyce Carol Oates. Still on Radio 4, but at 4:30 p.m, The Noisy Page. Kathy Fitzgerald considers the sounds that spring from famous texts. Then there is the drama on 3, Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m, and it's Lady Windermere's Fan by Oscar Wilde, directed by Martin Jarvis. While on Radio 4 Extra at 8 p.m, Derek Jacobi reads This Orient Isle, an account of Britain's first contact with the Muslim world. There's an early start to Monday, 10th of February at 9 a.m. on Radio 4, where you can start the week with Andrew Marr and his guests, who will be discussing the 75th anniversary of the Allied bombing of Dresden. You can exercise your little grey cells at 3 p.m. on Radio 4, when the Round Britain quiz asks intriguing questions and sometimes gets the right answers from the panellists. Radio 3 in concert at 7:30 p.m. includes works by Chopin and Sibelius. Then the Blues Show with Kerris Matthews on Radio 2 at 9 p.m. has vinyl classics, blues rock and beyond.
And now to Tuesday the 11th of February. Jim Al-Khalali discusses optical fibre, which now connects us all, with an expert from University College London at 9 a.m. on Radio 4. Still on a scientific theme, Secret History of Science and Religion examines the extent to which they have been in conflict with each other. This is at 3:30 p.m. on Radio 4 and is followed at 4 p.m. by Word of Mouth with Michael Rosen. For those who remember the original Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe, Arthur Dent rides again in this adaptation of Owen Colfer's novel and Another Thing by Dirk Maggs, with additional material by Douglas Adams. It begins at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4. More laughs can be found on Radio 4 Extra, beginning at 7 p.m. with The Goon Show, followed at 7:30 p.m. by Round the Horn. Mendelssohn's Elijah, recorded at the Barbican last week, is at 7:30 on Radio 3. Jamie Callum presents The Jazz Show at 9 p.m. on Radio 2. You can have a sublime start to Wednesday the 12th of February by following In Wordsworth's Footsteps with Jonathan Bate, who takes us to the West Country to hear about the poet's friendship with Coleridge. The Sounds of Love is explored at 9:30 a.m. on Radio 4 in The Curious Cases of Rutherford and Fry. It is the last episode of the very funny Conversations from a Long Marriage with Joanna Lumley and Roger Allam. Don't worry if you missed early episodes, as each one stands alone. Thinking Aloud is at 4 p.m. on Radio 4. Laurie Taylor and guests discuss water, the vital fluid we so often take for granted. Over to Radio 4 Extra at 6:30 p.m. for a look at the Palace of Laughter, Swansea, Grand Theatre, followed by two great comedians starting at 7 p.m. with Hancock's Half Hour, and then at 7:30, One Foot in the Grave with Richard Wilson. The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe is on Radio 2 at 9 p.m.
Now to Thursday, when we start with a long-running programme, but always worth a listen, from our own correspondent, is at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, followed at 11:30 a.m. by Cyrano for Hire, an investigation into the art of ghost-writing love letters. Whatever the weather, You can join Claire Balding on her ramblings at 3 p.m. on Radio 4. This week she goes to Winter Hill in Berkshire. This week's Great Lives on Radio 4 Extra at 6:30 p.m. looks at the life of the singer-songwriter Jake Thackeray. Stay with the same station at 7 p.m. for The Ken Dodd Show. Then, at 7:30 p.m, I'm sorry, I'll read that again. Beethoven's rarely heard oratorio, Christ on the Mount of Olives, is in a concert on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m, together with Berg's Violin Concerto. Bob Harris presents The Country Show at 9 p.m. on Radio 2. We start Friday, 14th of February, St. Valentine's Day, at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4 with A Normal Love. The writer and poet Henry Normal explores love, romance, and other unreasonable expectations. Tea Time Listening on Radio 4 Extra starts at 3 p.m. with a comedy drama, Crossing the Frontier. A woman goes on a cruise without her husband. Then at 4 p.m, Funny You Should Ask, a comedy quiz. The fun continues at 4:30 p.m. with Dry Slopes, and at 5 p.m. by The Lentil Sorters, a sitcom set in the Office of Local and National Statistics. Alternatively, you could go to Radio 4 at 4 p.m. for Last Word, and at 4:30 p.m, Tim Harford presents More or Less, which looks at numbers in the news. Over on Radio 2, Tony Blackburn's Golden Hour has a playlist including Neil Sedaka, Wham, and Texas. We hope you all have a great week's listening.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly Nature Notes for the Hearts Advertiser. Nature Therapy. When was the last time you saw a bumblebee? For me, it was last Wednesday, but the expected answer would surely be late summer last year. I wonder, have you too noticed some unseasonal events occurring in this particularly mild winter? In the same week, a swallow was photographed in Essex, and no less than 5 species of butterfly were recorded in Hertfordshire. Of course, if you're into making lists, these records give you a chance to get ahead with your year list of sightings. But I can't help feeling a little unsettled by these unnatural natural occurrences. We look forward to the march of the seasons, the return of the swallows in spring, and of butterflies in summer. The natural world often feels eternal, with trees hundreds of years old that stood in times very different from ours, and rivers and streams whose water has perhaps seen the sea many times. There is security and comfort in the enduring qualities of the natural world. There have been many occasions in my own life when I have literally escaped to nature to regain perspective and restore my state of mind. Growing up with an ill mother and complex family history often left me as a teen frustrated and at my wit's end. Spending time out walking in nature, whether in the wilds of Cornwall, the gentle hills of Dorset, or the more intensively worked countryside around St Albans, reconnected me with something greater than myself and altogether reassuringly stable, despite the uncertainties of life. I was saved time and time again from sinking into depression by the irrepressible joy and vitality of nature. Ironically, the one certainty in nature is change. Nature's stability lies in its dynamism, and that is also its greatest therapeutic quality. Depression is a closed world, a finite one, where only endings are visible, and the mind is trapped in a destructive infinite loop. Change is not possible to the depressed mind, and only hopelessness remains. The experience of nature is quite the opposite, with endless possibilities and surprises round each corner. Nature is a mind changer and a hope giver. Joe Harkness has talked lucidly about his ongoing battle with mental health in his excellent book Bird Therapy, and how the experience of nature, and in particular birds, opened up a pathway of hope and healing for him. He relates his discovery that the hobby of birdwatching perfectly embodies the five steps to well-being advocated by mental health charities such as Mind. The first step is to connect, then to take notice, to give, to keep learning, and to be active. Even a short walk in the countryside provides an opportunity to take at least four out of five of these steps. Nature has a way of grabbing our attention, maybe the unexpected flash of a kingfisher's blue along a river, or the exquisite beauty of a flower. And it's not long before we are engaged, lifted out of our finite world, if that is where we are, and open to other worlds and other thoughts. We find we are not alone in our discoveries, and that others have also heard the noisy song thrush, or noticed a particular flower in the woods. I love reading Mark Cocker's excellent diary of his forays into his local parish in Norfolk, Claxton. It is a collection of daily observations, mostly just a short walk from his home, pondering the wonders, variety and complexity that he encounters every day. What amazes me is how often our observations coincide, sometimes to the day. C.S. Lewis is often attributed with saying, "We read to know we are not alone." And Mark Cocker, though I have never met him, is nevertheless a companion on my own rambles through nature. Despite the disturbing observation of a bumblebee last week, I took comfort in the fact that Cocker's first entry in his follow-up, A Claxton Diary, published last year, records the same experience, a bumblebee on New Year's Day 2016. He says, "We sense instinctively that a midwinter bumblebee can be neither random nor without meaning." But in sharing, he reaffirms nature's ability to surprise and connect us together, and we are the much better for it.
Right, this is Peter Burley previewing events for you on a very, very cold, wet afternoon, previewing events from mid-February to mid-March 2020. But the first event I'm going to slip in, just to let you know it's happening, probably because you won't have time to get to it. This wasn't available, or the publicity wasn't available for the last recording, but on Saturday the 8th of February at 6 in the evening, there's a book signing and a meet and greet session with Michael Portillo, and that's going to be in Marlborough Road Methodist Church. And then at 7 p.m. he's going to give a talk, although it doesn't say what the subject of the talk is. However, the flyer has a picture of a train behind it, so it may well be linked to his television programmes on trains. It'll cost you £20, but all the proceeds go to the Salvation Army. Now, on to events I think you've got a chance of getting to in time, and we'll start in the cathedral. On Saturday the 15th of February at 7:30 p.m, the Hearts Chorus Concert will be a performance of Handel's Messiah. Tickets for that are £12, available from the cathedral box office. Saturday the 22nd of February at 5:30 p.m, there's an International Organ Festival concert, and this is given by Konstantin Volosnov, who was a first prize winner in 2009 here. And he'll be performing works by Bach, Mozart, Franck and Liszt. Those are free but with a retiring collection, as indeed is the next one, which is a lunchtime recital on Saturday the 7th of March at 1 p.m. It's a duet of classical guitar and classical accordion, and that'll be performed by Andrei Lebedev and Bartosz Grochid in the Lady Chapel. And the last event there in our little season here is a joint schools concert. And that's going to be on Wednesday the 11th of March at 7:30 p.m. And the joint schools are St Albans High School for Girls and the St Albans School. And they'll be performing works by Verdi, Wagner and Puccini, amongst others. Tickets are £10 for that. Now let's change musical style and go across to the Hertfordshire Jazz Club, who perform in the Maltings, and all concerts are 7 p.m. and tickets are either £14 or £12. 16th of February, we have Art Thiemann and James Wade Syard Quintet. 23rd of February, Julian Arguelles Quartet. 1st of March, the Leon Greening Quartet. And 8th of March, a Leon Richardson Quartet. They seem to have cornered the market in quartets for this season. Now, St Peter's Church have got four lunchtime concerts. These are all at 1 o'clock. On 19th of February, we have Catherine Clark on viola and Marcello Deda on violin. 26th of March, Ivan Rodriguez Deb on the piano. 4th of March, St Albans School Choir. And 11th of March, the Princess Helena College Choir. Now back to the Maltings for folk music. We've got one concert, which is on March the 6th, and it's two people performing, Paul Scarfield and Layla Burrows, and they combine voices, melodeon and the guitar. Tickets for that are £12 or £11. Now, the St Albans Symphony Orchestra have a big concert on the 7th of March. It's going to be in St Saviour's Church, and they're going to be performing Elgar Cello Concerto, Walton's Crown Imperial and Walton's Symphony No. 1. That's going to be at 7:30, I say, St Saviour's Church. Ticket prices are £16 for the nave or £12 for an unreserved seat in the aisle. Now, let's look at the arena, where we have a remarkably full programme, starting with Jack D and a one-man stand-up show called Off the Telly, but there is a warning that it had sold out before the programme went to print, but you may well get returns if you persevere. That's Saturday the 16th at 8 p.m. Then we have German Corner Jaws Tango Fire, which is a programme of tango music and dancing. It's Monday the 17th of February, 7:30 p.m. Tickets are £32, £28 or £24. Then we have another stand-up comedian on Wednesday the 19th of February at 7:30 p.m. And that's Adam Kay in a programme called This Is Going to Hurt. Tickets for that are £25. Then we have a musical on Thursday, the 20th of February at 7:30 p.m. It's called Menopause the Musical No. 2. It has a star cast, but they haven't announced who they are yet. Tickets for that will be £30. And we have Joe Brown, the original, real Joe Brown. He's in concert on the 21st of February at 7:30 p.m. Tickets for him are £31.50 or £29.50. Then we have a Elvis impersonator concert entitled The King Is Back. And the king in question is a chap called Ben Portsmouth. And he'll be performing on Saturday the 22nd of February at 7:30 p.m. Tickets £31.50 or £27.50. Then we have Rod Gilbert in his current one-man stand-up show. And that's called The Book of John. And rather like the previous one I advertised, it's sold out already, so you'll only get a return. Then we have another stand-up comedian, Ed Byrne, and his show this year is called If I'm Honest, and he'll be performing on Wednesday the 26th of February at 8 p.m, all tickets £25. Then we have another tribute concert, California Dreamin', a tribute to the music of the Mamas and the Papas. That's on Thursday the 27th at 7:30 p.m, all tickets £23.50. Then we have another tribute concert, We Remember Joe Cocker, and the Joe Cocker performer is a chap called Paul Cox. And he'll be performing on Friday the 28th of February at 7:30 p.m. Tickets £22.50. And it says, live at the Auburn Arena. The biggest names in stand-up comedy, it says. Book for your seats today. It doesn't actually tell you who you'll be seeing. It does promise you well-known TV comedy stars. And that evening of comedy will be on Saturday the 29th of February, 7:30 p.m. All tickets £25. On Monday the 2nd of March at 8 p.m., yet another sold-out concert. Now, this is another one-man stand-up comedy show by Rob Beckett, and it's called Wallop. Well, I'm bringing you all these because I do like to let you know the stars that visit the district and what's going on. And as I said earlier, you just might get a return if it's somebody you've got a particular sort of connection with or particularly want to hear. Now, something that isn't yet sold out, Rare Productions are presenting The Sound of Music. That's going to be live on stage on Thursday the 5th of March through to Saturday the 7th of March. 7:30 p.m. every one of those days, and then a Saturday matinee at 2:30 p.m. And then tickets range between £17 and £12.50, with concessionary tickets £1.50 off. Ah, we have the Count Arthur Strong show, and this year's is entitled Is Anybody Out There? And he's on Sunday the 8th of March at 8 p.m. All tickets for him, £22.50. I must say, I much preferred the radio version when it was on. The television series hasn't done it for me the same way. But on the radio, I think his style of performing comes across just wonderfully. Monday the 9th of March, 7:30 p.m, we have a one-man show by Ben Fogel, and it'll be entitled Tales from the Wilderness. And that all tickets for that are £27.50. Then we have another one-man comedy stand-up show by Tommy Tiernan, and it's entitled Tomfoolery. It's on Tuesday the 10th of March, 8 p.m, all tickets £21. Then we have Graziana Di Prima, a UK tour, and with music entitled Havana Nights. So this is Cuban-themed music. Wednesday the 11th of March, 7:30 p.m, tickets £28 to £27. There are concessionary tickets. If you want to meet and greet them, it will cost you £30. Then we have Mark Billy Bingham giving an audience. He is TV's most experienced, highest ranking and most decorated SAS leader and sniper. So if you want an evening of sniping, that's the place to go. That's in the arena, Thursday the 12th of March, 7:30 p.m, all tickets for him, £25. Now, back to something rather more traditional. There's a show just called The Crooners, and this is a tribute to The Crooners and the Rat Pack and so on. That'll be on Friday the 13th of March, 7:30 p.m. Tickets, £22, £20, and there are concessions. And then we have Rare Productions. And the last event we've got at the arena is the ELO Experience, and this is a tribute to the Electric Light Orchestra. And that'll be being performed on Saturday the 14th of March at 7:30 p.m. All tickets, £24. Now, let's move up north to Harpenden and the Public Hall. And we kick off on Saturday the 15th of February at 8 p.m. with a tribute concert called Absolute Bowie. They haven't, for whatever reason, put the prices on the current programme, so I can't tell you what the prices are. But I can keep going with a lot more events. Sunday the 16th of February at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, one performance only in the afternoon, we have the Grimethorpe Colliery Band. Friday the 21st of February, 7:30 p.m, there's a show by Ben Hart called Wonder. And I genuinely don't know, because the programme is really minimalist now, what that's about. However, the next one isn't a mystery. Wednesday the 26th of February, 7:30 p.m, the actual real Julie Felix will be performing. Then on Wednesday the 4th of March, 7:30 p.m, there's a tribute concert to Creedence Clearwater Revival, and it's performed by a group called The Fortunate Sons. And then lastly, we have the Straubs Acoustic 50th Anniversary Tour, and that's going to be on Thursday the 5th of March at 7:30 p.m. Friday the 6th of March, we have Jar Wobble and the Invaders of the Heart. Again, I don't know whether that's stand-up comedy or music. Friday the 13th of March, 7:30 p.m, The Style Counsellors, a programme called Café Blue. Now, they, I think, are a tribute band to The Style Council. And then lastly, on Saturday the 14th of March, we do another, I'm quite sure this is a tribute concert, 7:30 p.m, the Bob Marley Revival Evening. So that'll be a tribute to Bob Marley's music. Now, let's look at the drama in the district, and we'll kick off at the Abbey Theatre, who have a comedy night there, and that's being performed by the Humdingers, and they are going to have more hilarious headliners and sensational support artists, and that will be performed on the 27th of February at 8 p.m, tickets £15, and it's performed in the Studio Theatre. Then we have Ladies in Lavender, and that's being performed on the 28th to 29th of February, and then the 3rd to the 7th of March, at 8 p.m. on all those days, with a Saturday matinee on the 1st of March at 2:30 p.m. Now, Ladies of Lavender is a play by Sean McKenna. It was turned into a film a few years back, starring Judi Dench and Maggie Smith. And I have to tell you, if you want a sitting-on-the-edge-of-your-seat thriller, this play is not for you. I want absolutely nothing seen to happen in the film. Maybe on stage it works better. It's set in 1930s Cornwall, so it is actually very sort of scenic. Anyway, enough of that. Let's go up to the Maltings, and they've got several plays as well. The first one I previewed last month, but I'll just remind you that a play called Lossless by Stephen Thomas is being performed from the 13th to the 22nd of February, except for the 16th to 19th. And the performances are at 8 p.m. Tickets are £13.50 or £11. And it's about loss and memory. Then there's a play called Gone by Megan Jenkins, and that runs from the 27th to the 29th of February, 8 p.m. every evening. When a child vanishes without a trace from a stretch of remote woodland, the local community is ripped apart. Years later, with closure not an option, Lewis can still feel the tug of a little hand at his elbow. So it's a story of brutality and loss. Now, something which is genuinely very cheery, because I've seen it, is The 39 Steps, and it's based on the novel by John Buchan. And it's adapted for stage, and certainly the version I saw, it was an absolutely wonderful, rip-roaring, hilarious farce. Well, it says here, with a dash of Monty Python. And that'll be from the 12th to the 21st of March, except no performances on the 15th, 16th, 17th or 18th. All performances at 8 p.m. Tickets are £13.50 or £11. In Wheatamstead, there's an Agatha Christie thriller entitled Love from a Stranger, and that runs in the Memorial Hall from the 20th to the 22nd of February. Doors open at 7:30, performances at 8 o'clock. Tickets are available from the Manor Pharmacy in Wheatamstead. Now, at the Sandpit Theatre, here's one for all you football fans. There's an evening with Steve Perryman and Ozzy Ardiles. And these two football stars will just share their experience and talk to the audience for an evening. Now, it's going to cost you, though. It will cost £30 to listen to them. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. and they start talking at 7 p.m. And there's an opportunity for, I was in a book signing and a photo opportunity from 9:15 onwards. Now, there's a couple of spoken events on at the Museum and Gallery. Thursday the 27th of February was the Science Show-Off Comedy Night. This will take place around the building, but mainly in the courtroom. It starts at 7:30, finishes at 10, and it does have an intermission, and it will cost you £20. Then on Saturday the 7th of March, mostly in the Assembly Room, it's going to be an evening called Crime Scene Investigation at the Museum. So this is where a real crime scene investigator, Hayley Scott, actually talks us through what goes on in crime scene investigation. That starts at 7 o'clock, finishes at 9:30 p.m. and it'll cost you £25. Then there's a study day, which is on Saturday the 14th of March, and that's in two venues. Half of it's in the cathedral and the other half is in the museum. It starts at 10 in the morning, runs through to 3:30 in the afternoon, and it's entitled The City That Went Uphill. So it's a study of how the cities evolved from the Celtic settlement of Lamio through to Roman Verulamium and now to modern day St Albans. That will cost you £25. There are some light refreshments provided, which I assume means coffee and biscuits, but if you want to go, they recommend you take your own lunch. Now, Fleetville Diaries are up and running with their new season of talks. And the first one is very close to home for us, because Jenny trained as a nurse at Barts Hospital. And there's a session on Barts in Hearts. And this is on Wednesday the 26th of February at 7:30 in the evening. And it's going to be in the Fleetville Community Centre, which is off Hatfield Road. And Sarah Graham and Sue Gaylard will recall the removal of Barts from its site in Smithfield in London to Hill End Hospital for the duration of the Second World War. Now, the St Albans and Hertfordshire Architectural and Archaeological Society have three of their lectures in our period. Tuesday, the 18th of February, the lecture is Maritime St Albans by Anthony Oliver. And it's looking at the various really rather unexpected links between maritime history and St Albans, including, obviously, why so many ships have been HMS St Albans. And that's one of the things he'll be talking about. Now, that's in Marlborough Road Methodist Church at 7:45, as are the other two. Then on Tuesday, the 3rd of March, we have the Origins of the Grand National in St Albans. And that's given by Stephen Williams and Jean Yates. And this is the story of how in 1830, St Albans hostler and horseman Thomas Coleman actually invented the sport of steeplechasing. And here in St Albans, in Chequer Street. On Tuesday, the 10th of March, we have Housing for Victorian and Edwardian Working Women. And the speaker for that will be Emily G. Now, I said all of those are 7:45 Marlborough Road Methodist Church. If you're a member, they're free. If you're a non-member, it's £5. Now, a real one-off season of events, and quite a short one, is there's going to be a commemoration of the Battle of Stalingrad. And there's a travelling exhibition, which is currently, I think, at the time of this recording in London, but it'll be moving to St Albans at the end of February. And it'll be opened in the Museum and Gallery on the 28th of February. And it's a Russian exhibition, and there will be Russians involved in the programme. And what they're looking at is how the war effort in Hertfordshire affected what happened in Stalingrad, and things like any fundraising campaigns. And they knew before they started that quite a lot had gone on in Hertfordshire. Because, for example, a shipload of beds was sent from Welin to Stalingrad to help the casualties there convalesce. So we'll find out more about exactly what St Albans contributed, apart from a lot of war supplies, because it's absolutely obvious that companies like Marconi were making equipment which was being shipped to Stalingrad. So that's the exhibition, and that runs through till the 6th of March. That's the exhibition. Then on the 2nd of March, again at the Museum and Gallery, there's going to be a talk about Stalingrad by the Russian historian Belov Dmitri. That'll be at 5 in the afternoon, but they do warn that the exact time may still be subject to confirmation. I also don't know whether it'll be a ticketed event yet. There are various broadcasts on Radio Verulam. For example, on the 5th of March, there'll be interviews with the Russians, visiting Russians. And finally, on the 8th of March, it's going to be a special screening at the Odyssey Cinema of the most recent Russian film about Stalingrad. There have been several. Now, lastly, back to, I'd say normality, but something more annual and expected. February the 25th is the St Albans annual pancake race, and that takes place in the Market Square at noon. And then on the 29th of February, there is the St Albans Prosecco and Gin Festival in the Country Club. Like, I might try to find out more about that. But whether you're meant to have a cocktail of Prosecco with gin in it, I'm not sure. I think if we go there, I shall find that out. But if I do have several Prosecco and gin cocktails, I may be a bit late for the next month's recording.
As you know, we celebrate St Valentine's Day on February the 14th. But in Wales, they have their own saint, Dwynwen, the Welsh patron saint of lovers, which makes her the Welsh equivalent of St Valentine. Dwynwen is believed to have been a daughter of King Brechan Brycheiniog, who lived in the 5th century. Her mother may have been Rigfrust. Dwynwen, who lived in Anglesey, and her name is still recalled in place names such as Ynys Llandudwin and Porthdwyn, Wales, and the church of Sen Adwyn in Advent, Cornwall. Dwynwen lived in the 5th century, and legend has it that she was one of the prettiest of Brechan Brycheiniog's 24 daughters. Dwynwen fell in love with a prince called Maelon Dafodril, but unfortunately her father had already arranged that she should marry someone else. Dwynwen was so upset that she could not marry Maelson that she begged God to make her forget him. After falling asleep, Dwynwen was visited by an angel who appeared carrying a sweet potion designed to erase all memory of Maelon and turn him into a block of ice. God then gave three wishes to Dwynwen. Her first wish was that Maelon be thawed. Her second, that God meet the hopes and dreams of true lovers. And third, that she should never marry. All three were fulfilled. And as a mark of her thanks, Dwynwen devoted herself to God's service for the rest of her life. She founded a convent on Llandudwin, off the west coast of Anglesey, where a well, named after her, became a place of pilgrimage after her death in 465 AD. Visitors to the well believed that the sacred fish or eels that lived in the well could foretell whether or not their relationship would be happy and whether love and happiness would be theirs. Remains of Duinwen's church can still be seen today. Following the Reformation, devotions at her shrine were suppressed and the site itself quickly fell into disrepair through the effects of numerous sandstorms. Those pilgrims who still came to pray in the area visited Sentiland's well instead. During the 19th century, the Anglican Church rediscovered traditional devotions, in the course of which in the 60th year of Queen Victoria, probably 1879, a plain cross about 14 feet high was erected in memory of Duinwen. In 1903, a Celtic cross was erected near the ruins of the church by the Honourable F.G. Wynne of Glenfillan. During the 1960s, a student at University College Bangor, Vera Williams, sought to revive the observance of St. Duinwen's Day by commissioning four designs for St. Duinwen's Day cards in the style of a Welsh Valentine's Day. Another local press adopted the idea, and by 2004, the celebration of the 25th of January as a festival for Welsh lovers was so well established that even Gwynedd Council was promoting it. Popularity and celebration of St. Duinwen's Day has increased considerably in recent years. So, why wait until St. Valentine's Day to make your romantic feelings known when you can wish your beloved one Dwyandi Garodi, I love you, 3 weeks earlier on St. Duinwen's Day, which is celebrated in Wales on the 25th of January.
And here are some other dates you might like to be reminded of. In 1779... British naval captain James Cook, famous for claiming Australia for Britain, as well as many of the smaller Pacific islands, was killed by the Hawaiians. He had peacefully changed the map of the world more than any other single man in history. In 1858, Bernadette Soubirous saw a vision of the Virgin Mary near Lourdes in France. In 1876, Alexander Graham Bell patented the device we now know as the telephone. In 1945, the German city of Dresden was destroyed in a bombing raid. In 1964, Bob Dylan released his album The Times They Are Changing, and in 1964 the Beatles began their first tour of the United States, appearing on the Ed Sullivan Show for the first time. Nearly 74 million viewers tuned in. In 1965, Canada adopted its current national flag, showing a maple leaf. In 1969, the first Boeing 747 took off on its maiden flight. In 1971, the United Kingdom and Ireland decimalised their currencies. And then a year later, in 1972, the British government declared a state of emergency after a month-long coal miners' strike. In 1975, Margaret Thatcher became the first female leader of the British Conservative Party. In 1979, Trevor Francis became Britain's first million-pound footballer when he transferred from Birmingham to Nottingham Forest. In 1990, Nelson Mandela was freed after 27 years as a political prisoner. In 2000, the last ever Peanuts comic strip was published just hours after the death of its creator, Charles Schulz. In 2002, Princess Margaret, the Queen's independently spirited sister, died in London. And in 2005, Prince Charles announced his engagement to Camilla.
News and information about living with sight loss. From InfoSound.
The mobile phone market is a pretty crowded place these days, and there are no signs that that's going to change. We hear a lot about the top-end smartphones, the latest offerings from Apple and Samsung and the like, but some people prefer a simpler type of mobile, basically a phone with maybe a few extras. And for someone with vision impairment, sometimes simplest is best. There are one or two very simple mobile phones on the market, And one of the ones that probably fits into a sort of simple plus bracket is the Mini Vision phone. It can do more than just make and receive phone calls, and it does have a display screen, but it's not a touch screen. But interestingly, as we heard from Ash Cross at Sight and Sound Technology, which sells this and other phones, the Mini Vision has a standard physical tactile phone keypad.
The Mini Vision doesn't have a touch screen first and foremost, and it also has a physical keypad. It's very hard to find a phone on the market these days with a physical keypad where you can actually press to dial a number or write a text message, for example. If you imagine a blind user might find it very tricky to just use a touch screen to dial a number even. And the menu system is quite easily laid out. It's in a list view. It's not in that kind of grid that you would find on these modern smartphones. It's just a simple list where you can move up and down a menu to go to the phone application or the messaging application or whatever. It's very easy to use in that sense.
Right. So, and you say no touch screen, but of course about the top 60% possibly of the phone is a screen with that menu you described. Perhaps we could talk about that in a moment. But the tactile element, the bottom 40% of the phone, a standard layout there with a few extra buttons as well, I think.
Yeah, and they're like nicely separated as well. These are quite tactile, so you can easily tell the separate buttons apart from each other. So you've got your standard dial pad, 1 to 0, with the star and the hash key. And then above that, you've got the navigation key in the centre, which will take you up and down the menus. You've got a button in the middle, which is like the OK key to activate that menu. And you've got your end call key and your call key. Then there's like a menu key and a back key. So it's quite simple in terms of what buttons there are. Makes it nice and easy to navigate.
And the buttons themselves, these tactile buttons, what sort of colour contrast does the phone offer with those?
The buttons themselves are like a white on black. So a nice high contrast colour. The colour of the phone casing is white, and as I say, the buttons themselves are black. So nice high contrast theme.
And the menu system, now you've said it has this display screen outlining the various things you can do with a phone, which are what?
So it's got the essential parts that you'd expect from a phone. You want to call people, message people, text message. It's essential for like major features. So you've got your phone application, and you've got contacts list where you can enter your contacts, got messages for text messages. It's got features like alarm, calendar, FM radio, calculator, the weather, notes, and also colour detector built in. It's got a camera on the back where you can hover it over a garment or something that you want to know the colour of, and it will tell you what colour that is.
And you mentioned earlier about the layout of the menu. What options do you have in the sort of visual appearance of that screen? How big the text is, whether it's black on white, white on black, or whatever?
You can change the appearance of the screen. Some users prefer like a yellow on blue or black on yellow, yellow on black or whatever. I think by default it's white on black. You can customise it to whatever the user wants, really. You can magnify it, increase the size, and all sorts of modifications you can make there.
Is this all visual? Is there any sort of speech feedback with this phone, or is it the screen and the adaptability of what you can do with that screen that makes this accessible?
Both, really. So the Mini Vision caters for blind and low vision users. When you first turn it on, actually, you'll get a question that says, are you low vision or blind? Basically asking the question whether you want it as a magnifier or if you want the speech as well. You can still turn this feature on and off in the menu system. So that means you can have it just as magnification. You can change all the contrast and that kind of thing. But in addition to that, if you want to, if you're blind, it will speak as you're going through the menus. It's going to echo every key you press and every menu item that you move up and down on. So it can be a phone for the blind.
Now, the cost of the Mini Vision mobile phone, as sold SIM-free by Sight and Sound Technology, is £299. If you want the technicalities, it has 512 megabytes of internal memory, which can be expanded to 32 gigabytes using an SD card, which is not included, and it can be connected to 4G, 3G and 2G networks. And should you want to know anything else about this particular phone, including how it can be customised to an individual's choice, you can phone Sight and Sound Technology on 01604 798070. That's 01604 798070, or you can email them at info@sight.com. And sound smartvision.co.uk. Incidentally, also in the same family of phones, the Smart Vision 2 is said to be the only smartphone offering a triple interface of touchscreen, physical keyboard and voice synthesis with speech recognition. The basic version of that phone costs £499. You can buy individual add-ons such as OCR, a book reader and GPS, but you can also buy the phone with all these extras included for £599. Again, Sight and Sound Technology can tell you more about the Smart Vision 2 as well. Incidentally, all prices we've mentioned exclude VAT, which should not be paid on these phones if bought by a registered, blind or partially sighted person.
InfoSound. Depending on your level of residual vision, magnifying mirrors could be helpful for specific tasks that you may need to carry out on a regular basis, like applying eye drops, shaving or putting on makeup. And according to Nick Collins, a low vision advisor from Optima Low Vision Services, which sells magnifying mirrors, their usefulness is often overlooked.
Magnifying mirrors are an underrated low vision aid, in my opinion, because a lot of people think about mirrors as being something for vanity, but it's not, absolutely not. This is very important for many people, putting on makeup and things like that, and shaving properly and making sure your personal care is good. But it's also useful, you know, if somebody's putting an eye drop and things like that, and they find it difficult to do themselves, you know, this is really important. You can have different strengths of magnification with magnifying mirrors. It's not a broad range, so you're not going to have a huge step in magnification choice that you would with a traditional hand or stand magnifier, but they typically will have a lower power magnifier and then a more powerful magnifier. Some of them are combined, actually. You can have a combination of the two. But what you need to remember is typically with stronger magnifying mirrors, you'll have to have your eye or what you're looking at close to you, because if you're too far away, it'll look a bit distorted, like those sort of fairground mirrors. So you want to be nice and close to it. If somebody's vision is very, very different when they take the glasses off to when they've got their glasses on, if they're needing to take their glasses off to do the task, they don't see half as well. So a magnifying mirror can be very useful. Other times we don't often think is if one eye is very different to the other. So normally with both eyes open, using their better eye, they can read and do most things relatively well. But when they have to shut that good eye, if they're putting on makeup or if they're putting eye drops in and they can't see through that better eye, the magnifying mirror could be a very useful tool.
You said that the magnification strength, there isn't a huge range in terms of magnifying mirrors. What kind of range are we talking about? And interestingly, how does that compare with, for example, the high street mirror, which, you know, you can have a one times on one side, you flip it over and it has some form of magnification in it. How do the proper ones designed for vision impaired people sort of compare with the high street models?
Well, the gauging magnification on a magnifying mirror is a little bit tricky because it's not a like-for-like comparison, because it depends on how far you are from the lens and so on. But normally you're looking at about sort of 5 times magnification, and they can go 7, 10 times. I think there's some that even go up to sort of 14 times. It doesn't correspond with, for example, if you used a handheld magnifier. I wouldn't go down that road of comparing like-for-like. But basically it just gives you far more magnification than you'd normally be getting in a high street shop or so on, because they'll be working with people who don't really need a huge amount of magnification, just a little bit of a boost. So with these magnifying mirrors, it just gives us that bit extra magnification for people who struggle with using their half mirror and so on.
And the light situation always crops up when one talks about any sort of magnifier. You're also saying distance is critical, so you don't get too much distortion in what you can see in the mirror. Putting light and the way you're using a mirror together, how careful do you have to be in getting it right so you maximise the benefit of having a magnifying mirror?
Well, it can be tricky. Sometimes you can get away with the ambient light in the room, but quite often you'll benefit from an extra task light. Again, reflections with a mirror, guess what, is going to be quite tricky. So making sure that the light isn't blasting into your eye or anything like that, but making sure you get a nice even spread of light. Again, the way to judge that is that if you've got an external angle poise or an external task light, to use that. Sometimes your general bathroom lighting typically is quite bright anyway, so that tends to work quite well. It is possible for some of the magnifying mirrors to come with inbuilt lighting. So it'll have the mirror itself, but around it will have LED lighting as well. So you have the combination of magnifying mirror with the light as well. The problem with that is that light is not adjustable. So if it's not bright enough or it's too bright, there's not much you can do about that. But typically your good, well-lit bathroom will give you quite a lot of light for you.
And importantly, I'm guessing it's the light, because you're talking about the kind of mirrors that might have illumination that then throws the light back at the face. That's where you want the light, not bouncing off the mirror.
Certainly, yes. Yeah, yeah. So making sure you've got an even spread of light across your face or wherever you're looking to do. So if you're shaving or if you're putting makeup on, or, you know, I did talk about eye drops is sometimes challenging for people to administer on their own.
Would most of these mirrors typically be on some sort of stand that you put on a surface, or can they be mounted in other ways?
Well, you can have your compact ones that you sort of flip out and hold yourself, but I find most people tend to prefer ones that, if it's on like a gooseneck, sort of a flexible gooseneck arm, so you pop one side onto the table and it will keep it steady, and then you can manually adjust the goose arm to where you need it to be.
When one's talking about other types of magnifiers, I know that professionals like you will always stress the importance of matching a magnifier, I'm thinking of a handheld magnifier, for example, for the task that it's going to be used for, and therefore maybe more than one is needed. Does that same thinking apply to magnifying mirrors, or if you get it roughly right, can it be used for just about anything that one tends to do day to day?
It's not an exact science with this, to be honest, because I say people are going to use the magnifying mirrors will vary across each person. But if you can, try it out first. That's a great example. But also, there are some magnifying mirrors which have a combination. So they'll have one side will be, let's say, 5 times magnification, and if you flip it around, it'll be 10 times. So depending on your task, so if you want an overview of your face, so if you're shaving or if you're putting makeup on, you use one side. But if you need a bit more magnification, you know, if you're doing your eyeliner or if you've got any sort of eye drops or something that you want a bit more detail with and you don't need to see much of your face, just a small section, you can use a bit more magnification. Because there isn't a huge range of magnification across magnifying mirrors, typically, most people, this sort of between the 5 and the 10 or something like that, works quite well.
Now, some of the magnifying mirrors that Optima Low Vision Services sells include a 15x LED illuminated spot magnifying mirror designed for home and travel. The round 3-inch mirror sits in a silver finish mount that's 4.25 inches in diameter. It comes with 3 suction cups for mounting, maybe on a wall. It uses 4 CR2032 batteries, which are included, and the price is £18.60. They also sell 2 adjustable gooseneck mirrors that allow you to adjust the position and angle of, in both cases, a 5.75-inch diameter mirror. One mirror has a magnification of 7 times with a chrome and clear acrylic finish, and the gooseneck attaches to a chrome stand for sitting on a surface. It's also supplied with suction cups for mounting elsewhere, and this mirror is priced at £18.60. The other gooseneck mirror is a twin mirror design. It's a 5x and 10x double vision vanity mirror with a 5x mirror on one end and a 10x mirror on the other. It can stand on either end, like a vanity mirror, or it can be attached to a wall using a slide-on suction cup. And this twin mirror costs £26.03. Finally, they also sell a folding 1x and 10x LED illuminated mirror with dual LED lights, allowing one or both mirrors to be lit. Optima suggests this could be a travel mirror. It's 4.5 inches wide, 11.5 inches high when extended, and it folds down to 1.5 inches flat. The mirror size is 3.75 inches, and the price is £29.73. It uses 3 AAA batteries, which are not supplied. And should you want to find out more about these illuminated and non-illuminated magnifying mirrors, you can phone Optima Low Vision Services on 01 803 864 218. That's 01 803 864 218, or they can be emailed at sales@optimalowvision, that's optimalowvision, all one word, .co.uk.
Info Sound.